Okay, this hour with Sharon Weinberger, we're going to take your phone calls as we talk about DARPA. Her book is called The Imagineers of War, and we'll be back with her and you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, back with Sharon Weinberger. We're going to take your calls as we talk about DARPA. In your work, Sharon, what was the most fascinating aspect of DARPA that you uncovered for yourself?
I think for myself, there's an anecdote that always stays with me that was told to me by a guy who used to work at DARPA. And it was an anecdote about Nick Christopoulos, who was this Greek-American scientist who was not formally part of DARPA, but whose ideas became part of a lot of DARPA projects. And one of his ideas was a particle beam that was part of a top-secret program called Seesaw. And DARPA had worked on it for over 10 years, and just nobody thought it was going to work. And so one year, a DARPA program manager decided to hold a meeting of a bunch of scientists called the Jasons, who would advise DARPA on top secret issues. And Nick Christopoulos, the father of this particle beam idea, was there. And he was trying to demonstrate why this particle beam was never going to work, that it would take the entire American electricity grid to power it. And the DARPA guy was thinking, okay, I'm going to explain this to them, and they're finally going to agree the project was going to be killed. But instead, Nick Christopoulos, the scientist, talked about how they could set off nuclear weapons under the Great Lakes and drain the Great Lakes and power this particle beam weapon. And apparently all these scientists at the meeting were all nodding their heads saying, yeah, Nick, that's genius. Yeah. It might work. Let's bomb, nuclear bomb the Great Lakes and use that to power the particle beam. And that, to me, captured something about DARPA, this idea that, you know, no matter how ridiculously fantastical, you know, if it had some scientific integrity behind it, well, we might just try it.
Well, and I got to tell you, as far as I'm concerned, having been raised in Detroit around some of those Great Lakes, that's one of the extra wonders of this planet. And they wanted to ruin that?
Well, you know, that's part of the Cold War. This particle beam was going to shoot down Soviet ICBMs. And that was the idea of the Cold War, that when your nation is threatened, when it's a sort of existential existence is threatened, you consider any possibility, including setting off nuclear weapons under the Great Lakes.
Sharon, DARPA and Area 51, any crossover there?
Oh, absolutely. So, of course, Area 51 was used for quite a bit of top-secret testing of classified weapons, classified aircraft. So the first stealth prototype aircraft, which was a DARPA project, was tested at Area 51. Other black, you know, classified aircraft programs that DARPA sponsored over the years involving stealth and other areas were tested at Area 51. The rumor is that the current sort of top secret next generation bomber that the Air Force is developing grew out of drone programs that DARPA developed, which were probably tested at Area 51. So as sort of the classified testing area, it's had a lot of crossover with DARPA.
Let's go to some of the calls here for you now. They're lining up. We go to Eric, truck driving in Indiana. Welcome to the program. Hey, Eric.
George!
That's my signal from him.
This is Eric, the mind control guy.
Hello, Eric. Good.
Hey, I was going to ask the guest if she had ever heard of the book called, this is the title of the book, it's called The Patches. If I tell you, you would have to be destroyed by me. And what this book is, all these units that supposedly don't exist from a place that doesn't exist, Dreamland, more commonly known as Area 51, they have all these really bizarre and obscure patches there, and with all these different units and all these different projects. And some of them, you got to figure how serious these guys are, because one of the patches on there, now I'm sure you probably know what this means, but on the patch it says, NOYFB, and I'm sure you understand what that means. And they have other ones like a lifetime, the green door, a lifetime of silence. Some of these patches that are so bizarre, and these are the patches that are what these black projects are, and those are just the ones that were found out. And this has been years ago. And these aren't the, like, you know, the new ones that nobody even knows about, from Skunk Works and DARPA and Greenland and all that. And I didn't know if your guest had ever come across that book. It's on Amazon. I got it several years ago.
Patches.
So I was going to ask her about that.
All right. Go ahead, Sharon.
I'm not sure if I know that specific book, but the caller is absolutely right that there's this fascinating history of people who look at the patches, which are, you know, for different military units, also classified programs. One of my favorite, and that's a favorite among national security reporters, is there's a famous patch of a classified launch by the National Reconnaissance Office, which launches spy satellites. And the patch was for a specific mission that was classified, but you know, was for, we know it was for a spy satellite. We just don't know which one or what it was doing. And it was an octopus enveloping the globe. And so he's absolutely right. You can, you, people have tracked a lot of classified programs by looking at these mission patches, which are, you know, skull and bones, octopuses enveloping the globe. Sometimes they give you hints about what a program does. Sometimes they're obscure, but we know that they're each linked to something. And you can look at them and trace a lot of fascinating history.
Do the Russians have the same kind of agency as we have with DARPA?
So they don't quite have a DARPA. A few years ago, Vladimir Putin announced that, you know, Russia would form its own DARPA, but I don't think they've really done anything equivalent. You know, it's very hard. It is very unique, and perhaps something unique to the U.S. government to say, you know what, we're going to give a few billion dollars a year to a government agency and let them kind of do, within reason, whatever they want. And I don't think that the previously the Soviet system and now the Russian system, I don't think they're willing to let their scientists or even their military scientists have that sort of freedom. Now, the Europeans have tried the same thing. They every few years they talk about, you know, the EU or specific countries are going to establish a DARPA. But in Europe, the problem is different. They're not comfortable having the military fund research and development to the extent we do in the United States. So lots of other countries have talked about it. Nobody has really created the equivalent of DARPA. It's unique.
Kind of reminds me of the James Bond movies where Q was heading up all those areas that came up with these different gizmos and things for James Bond to use.
Yeah, a lot of that. And DARPA has gone through periods in its history where it's operated like a bit more like a Q agency. Certainly in the Vietnam War period, you know, they were experimenting with things like pontoons for soldiers, you know, sort of shoes that would allow soldiers to walk on water or go down Vietnamese waterways, or, you know, a single-person light aircraft that a soldier could use. At one point, they were looking at sort of foldable bicycles for soldiers. But that sort of very rapid response, gimmicks and gadgets for soldiers, was a little bit unique to that period. They did a little bit of it at the height of the Afghanistan and Iraq War, but not quite as much. They tend to focus more on sort of the future projects now rather than on, you know, what's a gizmo or gadget we can give a soldier today or tomorrow.
Well, with Sharon Weinberger, her book is called The Imagineers of War. Let's go to Barbara in Los Angeles now. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. I find a lot of this discussion very disheartening, especially since my taxes are going to fund all these
They sure are.
Weapons, things, and I'm just thoroughly disheartened by it. And I know people that have been in the defense business. That's a story for another time, and it's just ghastly. I just can't endure it.
But wouldn't you like to have an agency, Barbara, working for our behalf, quietly and secretly?
Well, who's doing the ethical oversight? That's what I want to know.
Is there any oversight there, Sharon?
Well, that's a great point. DARPA has certainly got into a lot of problems when it hasn't had oversight. So one of its most controversial programs after 9/11 was this program called Total Information Awareness, which was going to trawl through all of sort of the databases in the United States, everything from classified databases on terrorists to credit card records, to car rental records, hotel receipts, to try to spot sort of the next terrorist plot in the United States. And it caused this huge backlash against DARPA when it was made public in around 2002, 2003, and got involved in congressional hearings. You know, the New York Times said this is a George Orwell type program, Big Brother is watching you. And one of the lessons that came out of that was DARPA, since then, when they've done programs in data mining, they have sort of a privacy board that overlooks some of these things. With their neuroscience work now, there's quite a bit. Well, I don't know how good the oversight is, but there are boards that look at the ethics of the work and provide oversight. I think this is an eternal question for the United States. You know, when I've given talks about DARPA in Europe, they are, as the caller is, very aghast. There's much higher tolerance for military-funded research and development in the United States. Whether you think that's good or bad, to some extent depends on how you look at military-funded research. But DARPA has run into problems over the year when it hasn't had proper oversight. I think there is reason to be concerned, even if you support the idea of a military science and technology agency.
Next up, Luke, truck driving in Texas. Hey, Luke, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, I had a question. She mentioned earlier something about brain waves and our ability that they were working on our ability to, like, move things like drones and keyboards and stuff like that. Could they possibly really be looking in the possibility of controlling our brain waves?
That's another possibility, don't you think, Sharon?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and DARPA has, you know, they try to skirt around the language of it, but this was a concern for the program in the 1970s when it was first started. At the time, it was called biocybernetics. You know, if you can do one thing, if you can tap the brain signals to control a mechanical arm, a cursor on the computer screen, you know, theoretically, you can also work the other way, even though that wasn't the goal of the DARPA program. So fast forward, that was in the 1970s, so let's fast forward to the early 2000s, where once again, they're looking at this brain-computer interface work, and there were proposals looking at it the other way. You know, can you change the brain? So right now, they're very careful about how they couch the language of the research. So they're talking about implanting brain chips to treat the brain, to treat depression, or to treat, for instance, soldiers who are suffering traumatic brain injury and are having problems with memory. But again, these are things that are actually modulating the human brain. Now, of course, it's done for treatment to help the human brain, but if you help the human brain, you can do other things with it too. This has always been sort of an implicit idea of the program, not just to read the brain signals, but also to change the brain. And, you know, at the end of the day, DARPA is a military agency, and that goes back to what the office director of this biological technologies office told me. You know, if we come up with something that's a military strategic advantage relating to neuroscience, relating to the human brain, that, you know, they might classify it.
Let's go to Susan in British Columbia. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Hello. I hope my battery holds out. I'm glad you got Tim Ball on tonight, because I finished my career working in the same department as he did on that work.
Ah.
I started my career in DARPA and when I was an undergraduate student to do with the hypersonic-type aircraft. My father worked on the Avro Arrow when we were stationed at USAF Wright-Patterson in the early 50s until they brought in the DARPA program in 58,
right.
And the DART took over where the Arrow left off. And it was a very successful aircraft. The double-edged sword on the software that I had to write for the military projects, it ended up my conscience can live with itself, because it ended up in things like MRI machines. The last project I was hired back about 30 years later by people that had been in my first military lab, and we were working in magnetoencephalography, and we were studying epileptic seizures of the brain, with the intent that we could map them out and understand them and potentially do something to cancel their signals without damaging the tissue in the brain from the outside, which means we were using quantum physics to observe the brain activity. And my big concern, my dad was dying and he wanted me home, And he had worked in radar during World War II, and the psychologists had seen an interaction between an enhancement in their perception on with the radar equipment. It would have been to do with the magnetic fields when he was sending and receiving aircraft coming back in during World War II. And he asked me what I was working on, and he'd always wanted to be doing what I was doing, but he became a lawyer instead. He called it the mind reader. And so I'd also made friends with a retired psychologist who had worked in the PAIRS research program. And when I was working in my submarine warfare signal processing, PAIRS was doing obviously doing at the same time, from what he told me, remote viewing. And the intent was to decipher whether man-made sensors or the human capabilities were better, which was better in detecting incoming events, whether it's an asteroid, whether it's a seismic event right. coming in.
Did they make any conclusions with that, Susan?
At that time in the 70s, the human perception was better. And it was all the same signal processing, using it for medical, for natural event, forecasting natural events or military events. So the hypersonic stuff is just an extension of what we were doing in the 50s and 60s. We can use the same techniques there. So, but the medical, like pacemakers, the imaging, the brain imaging we were doing with the magnetoencephalography, which is now in the U.S. government. It was developed here in Western Canada by guys I worked with in the early 70s. They rehired me. I didn't know until they hired me why they'd hired me back. My concern was with the brain research and what was going on with the over-the-horizon radar. If they can do it remotely, is they can put you on the ground now with high frequencies and interfere with your signals in your muscles, so you're in agony on the ground in crowd control. My concern is, can they jam the brain externally?
I bet they could. Do you want to react to any of that, Sharon?
Yeah, there's an interesting thread to pull out of there. So one of the questions right now is about artificial intelligence. You know, what's better, the human brain or artificial intelligence?
And how far will they take it?
Yeah, so I spoke to this one DARPA-funded researcher who was talking about, you know, okay, let's take driverless cars. So you take sort of, you know, AI, artificial intelligence, trying to make decisions on the road. It's not that great yet, but it's getting pretty good. And they tested that against the perception capabilities of basically an insect, a moth hooked up to sensors. You know, so what can sense or detect better? You know, and what they determined was, you know, basically this moth linked up to a computer still had better perceptual capabilities than the equivalent computer. Basically, what's still better, the living organism or artificial intelligence? Today, the living organism is still better, but will AI eventually overtake it? That's what computer scientists are betting on. But I find that a fascinating question. You know, if you what will win, the brain-computer interface or the computer? Right now, the brain-computer interface is winning. Maybe that's what wins in a long time, that we're sort of melded with machines in some way.
It could be. Sharon, would you give out your website, please?
Sure. My website is www.sharonweinberger.com.
And, of course, we've got the link for everybody at coasttocoastam.com. We're going to come back and take final questions with Sharon Weinberger, author of The Imagineers of War. What's your next project, Sharon?
So a little bit of an offshoot of the DARPA book. With all of the controversy right now about elections and who's swaying elections, are the Russians swaying elections, the controversies over fake news, I want to do a history of how the military itself and Cold War concerns led to a lot of the technology and a lot of the science around trying to sway people in elections.
Oh, that'll be a great topic. You're back on the show when that book's done, too. Let's come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll take your final calls. George Norrie back with you, along with Sharon Weinberger, as we talk about her work, The Imagineers of War, and we're going to get to your calls as well. Sharon, when you were putting together the book, was there an area there that was, for you, the most fascinating?
I think the Vietnam War period.
Still, okay.
It was this mix of everything that we've talked about, the idea of sort of the Q of James Bond, that they were doing a mix of sort of gimmicks and gadgets, spy things for soldiers. They were doing far-reaching technologies, things that eventually became sort of the origins of drone warfare, of stealth aircraft, of using computers in warfare. And so it was a mix of everything, and it was very classified and top secret. And I think most people today don't realize how deeply DARPA was involved in counterinsurgency in the Vietnam War. They had over 500 personnel in Bangkok, Thailand alone, because Thailand was considered sort of the soft laboratory for things that could be used in Vietnam. But they also had offices in Saigon, Vietnam. They had counterinsurgency labs in Tehran, Iran, in Beirut, Lebanon, in Panama. They had a very global vision that we're going to be the counterinsurgency science laboratory and solve this problem around the world. And I think that global vision was very surprising.
Do you think DARPA was created primarily, at least under the table, for weaponization or for peaceful purposes?
Oh, weaponization. I mean, absolutely. It's a military agency. I mean, certainly the idea that, you know, weapons can help solve warfare, can keep the peace, but let's have no illusions. It's a military agency. The military builds, deploys, develops weapons to wage and win wars.
Well, absolutely. Okay, back to final calls. Charles in Elgin, Texas with us. Go ahead, Charles.
Yes. Well, when I was at Berkeley, we could discuss a lot of things,
Charles, your phone needs some work. Try to get a better connection, if you would. Let's go next to Joe in Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Joe.
Hi, Sharon. Mission Impossible. Just came out with Tom Cruise. But two questions. One would be, how much of this stuff has been organized as a network and premised on a network, such as the placement of satellites, the coverage of stealth aircraft or war aircraft? So that'd be one question. The second question would be the rogue elements involved potentially due to the AI aspects and other aspects, such as the drones possibly losing the signal, becoming rogue, and maybe the operators of these machineries becoming rogue, such as stealth, where they could do that easily, more easily due to the technology. And really also, when you mention Europe, there's a lot of at-risk infrastructure that wasn't the case in World War II, such as the nuclear reactors. If any of them were to be meltdown, you've got a major risk to, among other things, food supplies all over the place, such as Chernobyl. They had to throw out like all the lettuce, et cetera, and Italy that whole season. All the vegetables had to be thrown out.
Oh, God.
Well, let me take the first part of that where you talked about the network. So a lot of what DARPA has done over the years is exactly that, network things together. They were networking computers together so they could speak to each other. They were networking seismic sensors around the world to create a network to detect secret Soviet nuclear tests. As you talked about satellites, a lot of what DARPA did, military as well, is trying to connect data to get one sort of operating picture to share and exchange data. So that's the network. Regarding the other issue with artificial intelligence, you know, this is an area that, of course, is getting a lot of publicity. And, you know, you're hearing reports of, you know, that you could have rogue artificial intelligence. And I think those concerns are valid. I think they're still a little bit in the future. But what I tell people is it's fine to worry about rogue artificial intelligence and to worry about artificial intelligence in warfare. But the truth is, humans have proven pretty adept at killing other humans. Are you really that much more worried about smart computers? If you're going to worry about something, worry about the effects of warfare, of, you know, drones killing people. Does it really matter to the people who are killed whether it's a drone controlled by a human or whether it's controlled by a computer? You know, warfare is inherently a result of humans, of the human condition. I'm not overly worried about the potential in some future decade, and more likely centuries away, if possible, of true artificial intelligence. I worry more about warfare in the here and now.
And what about DARPA going rogue? Is that possible?
Well, yeah, I think the Vietnam War period was a good example of that. One of the people that I profile in my book is this guy, William Godel, who'd been sort of a true intelligence operative in World War II, sort of this up-and-coming star of the intelligence community who was very vital in the early years of DARPA. And he basically saw DARPA as sort of an extension of black ops and used that. He was implementing a lot of work in Vietnam on behalf of General Edward Lansdale, who was this another sort of notorious figure of counterinsurgency. They were on one hand answerable to the goals of U.S. government, but they were doing a lot of things without explicit permission for the goals of national security. And a lot of that was considered sort of going rogue. So I think any time you have an agency like DARPA that has a lot of money and it has independence, you know, there are going to be people who, even if for good intentions, mm-hmm. are going to sort of use it for rogue purposes.
Well, and Godel, who was a deputy director of DARPA, he believed that scientists should be working for DARPA, not the other way around.
Yeah, so it comes out of the post-World War II era, right up to Sputnik, where there was this real sort of flowering of science. You know, the government was pouring money into science. And then Sputnik comes around, and people like William Godel, the deputy director of DARPA, said, you know, his statement was, enough of this. You know, we don't serve scientists. Scientists should be made to serve national security, to serve the country. You know, he had a real different vision that you don't support science for science's sake. You support science to support national security. And that is the entire underpinning of DARPA. It's not a science agency. It's a national security agency that supports science.
Let's go to Joseph in San Diego. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask your guest maybe one or two questions really quickly.
Sure.
I'm very concerned about the CIA. We haven't heard about them for a couple years doing anything malicious. I think ever since Kennedy was shot, we all know who's the top tier, who controls the country, and could even be the world. I don't know. It could be CIA, FBI, but I really sincerely believe it's the CIA, and I'd like your thoughts on that. And the second question is, I heard from some reliable resources that the Germans that were brought over had studied the Indian Vedic text to analyze. They had flying machines that they didn't understand the propulsion system from the Vedic literature, but they did get some knowledge for NASA and for our military. But those two points, I would like you, and I'll take my answers off the phone. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Sure. So let me talk about the CIA. You know, I've long been an advocate of transparency, of government transparency. There is a role for classification in government, but I believe it should be fairly limited. This is our taxpayer dollars. And, you know, certainly the CIA is much more secretive than DARPA. There is a fair amount of DARPA that you can find out about that is in the public realm. I think it's a valid question to ask, you know, there is a reason to keep intelligence operations classified. I think there is far too much classification for the CIA. I think we should have, at least historically, a much better idea of the types of things they've been involved in. The CIA, you know, there is this crossover between DARPA and the CIA on classified technology. For instance, the CIA was also involved in some early stealth research. They've also been involved in a lot of aviation and aircraft programs. I think there should be much quicker review and declassification of all records for the CIA as well.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And who does DARPA report to?
So DARPA reports to the Secretary of Defense. Now, it's been moved down. You know, in the early days, there was a lot of interest from the White House, from the President and DARPA, and a lot of interest from the Secretary of Defense. One of the things that I think has happened over the years is it's been sort of downgraded a bit in the Defense Department bureaucracy. So now I think technically, I mean, it's ultimately reports up to the Secretary of Defense, but its immediate report is to, I believe, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, so a little bit lower. I don't think Mattis, the current Secretary of Defense, I don't think he's that interested in DARPA. I mean, I'm sure he's, you know, it's fine that it exists, but it's not something, he's not someone that has a personal interest in science and technology like perhaps some previous Secretaries of Defense have had.
Next up, we have Tyler in Reno, Nevada. Hi, Tyler, go ahead.
You have the best bumper music in the whole world of radio.
Thanks, Tyler.
I love it. I used to serve on a DARPA committee. I was with Second Fleet back in Norfolk, and the committee was hosted by Cinquain Fleet. I just wanted to call for a couple of things. The main thing was is that my experience with DARPA was that it was a very practical research agency. They would get out into the field with their staff and talk to people who were, like in my case, mine warfare specialists, and work specifically on the problems that we faced. But at the time, this was about 18 years ago, we had a problem with a type of mine that one of our adversaries had developed that was kind of hard to find and would, you know, probably play havoc during wartime. And so we really had to find a better way to hunt mines rather than the old hunt magnetic signatures thing that we used to use. And I'm not going to give away any classified material, but I wanted to impress upon your audience how deliberate and highly charged these scientists were. They were both people that were on the staff at DARPA, and they were also contract people, like from Raytheon and places like that. And they were very eager to solve problems not 6 years down the road, but as soon as possible, as if we were going to go to war the very next week. And that was what I really loved about working with the DARPA people, was that I could mention something like I had a problem with types of marine animals getting in the way of what I was trying to do while I was out hunting mines. And they'd get together with Panama City, which is another research organization for the Navy. And within a couple of months, they'd have a solution. And that's exactly the way it ought to work. It's not, you know, spooky stuff all the time. A lot of it's just real practical stuff. The other thing is that I'm retired from the Navy now, and ironically, I'm studying neuroscience. you were just talking about that. And one of the things I really wish people would do, and this applies to all your audience, if you are working for a company and you think you have something that might be of value to the defense establishment, talk to somebody who works in the field that you're trying to address. We used to have people come to our office from some of the big defense companies that you are well familiar with, and they would pitch some of the most pie-in-the-sky nonsense that you'd ever want to hear. Nobody had asked for it. Nobody wanted it, and we didn't even have a need for it. But
they wanted money.
Out there, yeah. Well, I mean, they wouldn't bother to ask us what our needs were, which was really the beauty of DARPA, is that those guys would get around into the field units and go, what do you guys need? your enemy's got a bunch of cans. Maybe you need a can opener.
So many companies, Tyler, do things without getting the advice of the people who are actually the workers.
Exactly. Well, I really encourage people, if you work for a company, to like get some interface with people who are out there in the field using this stuff. And then the second thing I was going to offer is that we need to beat up Congress, not to reduce defense research spending, but to make sure that we're spending a large amount of research outside the defense area as well. So much of our defense money, I mean, so much of our research money now comes via the Defense Department, and that's not healthy for our society. I'd really like to be working on re-innervation of tissues, how to grow, regrow arms and legs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I have to go begging to the National Science Foundation or DOD. So there's so few outlets for research money right now that have come via the private sector or from the nonprofit sector. So have a good night. Nice chatting with you.
All right, good. Good observations there, Tyler. Really appreciate it. We're coming up to an end, about a minute left, Sharon, and it's an amazing story with DARPA. What is their budget? Do we know?
Yeah, their budget is about $3 billion. It goes up and down, but it's kind of hovered around that area for the past, you know, 8 or 9 years. Its budget is tied to the greater Defense Department budget. When our military spending goes up, DARPA's budget goes up. When it goes down, it goes down. Right now, our defense budget is on an upward trajectory.
Does their money come from black ops programs or straight from taxpayer money?
It's taxpayer money, but DARPA has over the years been used actually as a cutout, meaning there are things that are look as DARPA programs, but in fact are covers for the intelligence community. So it's actually the other way around. They're providing the cover.
Keep in touch with us, Sharon, okay?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Up next, we're going to talk about the harmonic universe as we go live to Wales right here on Coast to Coast AM.